No, rather, mastering the passion and storing it within his own soul with great forethought, he feigned estrangement, both in his looks and his voice and everything else, playing the part of one displeased, and said, "You have nothing peaceable in mind, you men, but some enemy of the king has sent you as spies, to whom, having agreed to render evil services, you thought you would go undetected. But nothing done in ambush escapes notice, even if it is shrouded in deep darkness." When they tried to defend themselves and explained that they were being accused of things that had never happened, that they had not come from enemies, nor were they themselves at odds with the local people, nor would they ever submit to such a service, for they were peaceable by nature and had learned almost from earliest childhood to honor stability under a most holy and God-beloved father, who, having 12 sons, kept at home the youngest, not yet of age for travel. While the 10 of us present here were before his eyes, and the remaining one had disappeared, when he heard this, as though it concerned himself dead at the hands of those who had sold him, what must his soul have felt? For even if the passion that came over him then did not burst into speech, still, smoldering and rekindled by these words, his insides were altogether ablaze. Yet with a deep composure he said to them, "If you really have come here not to spy out the land, then as proof of my trust, stay here yourselves a short while, and let your youngest brother come, summoned by letter. But if you are in haste to leave for your father's sake, fearing perhaps your long separation from him, let all the rest of you depart, but let one remain as a hostage until you return with the youngest. The penalty against those who disobey shall be set at the highest, death." Having uttered such threats, and looking at them askance, and giving every outward proof of heavy anger, he withdrew. But they, filled with anxious thought and dejection, reproached themselves for their plot against their brother, saying, "That crime is the cause of our present troubles, the overseeing justice of human affairs already contriving something against us. For having rested quietly a short while, it rises again, displaying its own implacable and inexorable nature toward those who deserve punishment. And how are we not deserving? We, merciless as we were, disregarded our brother when he begged and implored, though he had done no wrong, but had only, out of family affection, reported to us as to familiars the visions he had in his sleep. Because of which we, most savage and wildest of all, in our displeasure did unholy things, for one must not lie. Therefore we expect to suffer these things, and worse still, we who alone, of almost all mankind, called well-born on account of the surpassing virtues of our fathers and grandfathers and ancestors, have disgraced our lineage, having been eager to acquire a notorious reproach. But the eldest of the brothers, who at the beginning too, when they were plotting together, had opposed the scheme, said, 'Now that the deed is done, regrets are useless. I urged you, I entreated you, weighing how great the wickedness was, not to indulge your anger. But when you ought to have agreed with me, you yielded instead to your own rash counsels. Therefore we now reap the wages of our willfulness and impiety. The plot devised against him is being sought out, and the one who seeks it is no man, but God or reason or divine law.' These things the brother who had been sold heard them murmuring quietly among themselves, with an interpreter standing between. And overcome by emotion and about to weep, he turned away so as not to be discovered, and having poured out hot, unceasing tears and finding some relief, he wiped his face, turned back, and ordered the second eldest of the brothers to be bound before the eyes of them all, the one corresponding to himself in order, for the second among several corresponds to the second to last, just as the first corresponds to the last, but rather God or reason or divine law. The brother who had been sold heard these words as the men spoke quietly among themselves, with an interpreter standing between them. Overcome by feeling, and about to weep, he turned away so as not to be discovered, and poured out hot tears one after another. And when he had found a little relief, he wiped his face and turned back, and ordered that the second oldest of his brothers be bound before the eyes of all the others the one who matched his own position. For among several brothers, the second from the end corresponds to the first, just as the last corresponds to the first. Perhaps, too, it was because this brother seemed to have contributed the greatest share of the wrongdoing, all but marshaling the others and inciting them to hostility. For if he had joined the eldest brother, who was counseling kindly and humane action, then being younger than him, but older than the rest, the wrong might well have been checked. since the two of highest rank and honor would have been of one mind and one purpose about a matter which, on its own weight, carried great influence. But as it was, he abandoned the gentler and better course and deserted to the savage and harsh one, and once set up as its leader, he so emboldened his partners in the crime that they carried the reprehensible contest through without flinching. For these reasons, he alone, of all of them, seemed to me the one who deserved to be bound. Meanwhile, the others were already preparing for the journey home, since the steward of the country had ordered the grain sellers to fill all the brothers' sacks as though for strangers, and secretly to place the money they had received at the mouths of the sacks, without telling those to whom they gave it back, and further to add a third thing besides provisions sufficient for the road, set apart, so that the grain they were bringing back might be delivered undiminished. As they journeyed, naturally pitying the brother left in bonds, and no less downcast about their father, wondering whether he would again hear of a disaster diminishing and cutting away at his blessing of many children with each new road and saying, "But he will not even believe he has been imprisoned. He will suppose the chains are merely a pretext for his death, since those once struck tend to stumble against the same thing again." Evening overtook them, and after unloading the burdens from the pack animals, they set some down to lighten them, but they themselves took on heavier cares in their souls. For it is the way of the mind, in the body's times of rest, to seize upon more vivid images of what one does not wish to see, and to be crushed and weighed down all the more grievously. One of them, untying a single sack, saw beside its mouth a purse full of silver, and counting it out, found that the very price he had paid for the grain had been given back to him. And struck with astonishment, he reported it to his brothers. But they, suspecting not a kindness but a trap, lost heart, and wishing to search through all the sacks, yet fearing pursuit, they set out and pressed on as fast as they could, running almost without pausing to breathe, and cut short a journey of many days. Then, one after another, they embraced their father, not without tears, kissing him as he clung to and poured himself out upon each one in turn, though his soul was already divining something unwelcome. For he noticed those who came forward to greet him, and he found fault with the son who was missing for lagging behind, and he kept looking toward the doorway, eager to see the full number of his children. But when no one else came in from outside, they saw him thrown into alarm at what he did not wish to believe, and they said, "Father, uncertainty is more painful than knowledge. For the one who learns has found a path to safety, but doubtful ignorance is the cause of a hard road and helplessness. So hear a story that is very painful, but necessary to tell. The brother who was sent with us to buy grain and has not returned is alive, for we must first free you of the greater fear, that he is as good as dead and living. He remains in Egypt with the steward of the country, who, whether from some slander or from a suspicion of his own, brought against us the charge that we were spies. When we defended ourselves as the moment allowed, telling him about you, our father, and about the brothers left behind, one dead, and the other staying with you, whom we said we had left at home, because he was still young on account of his age stripping bare, and laying open everything about our kinship so as to remove suspicion, we accomplished nothing. Rather, he said the only proof of a truthful account would be for the youngest boy to come to him, and that this was why he had detained the second brother, as security and pledge for him. This demand is the most painful of all, but the moment, more than the one who commands, is what imposes it, and we must of necessity obey it for the sake of provisions, since only compliance will supply them to those pressed by famine." But he, groaning most heavily, said, "Which shall I mourn first? The last remaining son, who did not draw the last place but the first in the ranking of misfortunes? Or the second son, who took the second prize among evils, chains before death? Or the youngest, who will set out on the most dreaded of journeys, if indeed he goes, having learned no caution from his brother's misfortunes? As for me, torn apart limb from limb and part from part, for children are parts of their parents, I am in danger of ending up utterly childless, I who until just now was accounted a father rich and blessed in sons." But the eldest said, "I give you my two sons as hostages, the only ones I have fathered. Kill them if I do not bring back safe the brother entrusted to me, who, once he comes to Egypt, will secure two very great things for us. First, clear proof that we are not spies or enemies, and second, the power to recover our brother from his bonds." The father was greatly distressed and said he was not unaware that, of the two sons born of the same mother, one was already dead, and the other, left bereft and alone, would dread the road, and would die in effect from fear even while still living, remembering those terrible things that had happened to befall the first. While he was saying this, they put forward the boldest of them, one naturally suited to command and skilled in speech. He was fourth in age from the firstborn, and persuaded him to convey to their father what they had all agreed upon. It seemed best, since necessities were running low for the grain brought back before had already given out, and since need was pressing and gaining the upper hand, that they should go to buy more. But that they would not go if the youngest stayed behind, since the steward of the country had forbidden them to appear without him. So, reasoning like a wise man, he said to them, "It is better to give up one son to an uncertain and doubtful future than to face the acknowledged destruction of so many, which every household will suffer once pressed by want and incurable disease." He said to them, "But if the demands of necessity are stronger than my own will, I must yield. For perhaps nature is arranging something better, which she does not yet think fit to reveal to our minds. Take the youngest, then, as you have resolved, and go, but not in the same manner as before. Formerly, silver alone was needed to buy grain, when you were unknown men who had suffered nothing irreparable. But now gifts are needed as well, for three reasons: to win the favor of the governor and grain master, by whom you say you are recognized; to recover our brother from his bonds all the more quickly by paying a large ransom for him; and to heal, as far as possible, the suspicion of spying. Take, then, of all that our land produces, and carry it to the man as a kind of first fruits, along with double the silver, both what was returned to you before, which was perhaps returned through someone's oversight, and another sum sufficient to buy the grain. Carry with you also our prayers, which we offer to God our Savior, that you may find favor with the people of that land while you sojourn there as strangers, and return safely, restoring to your father the precious deposits entrusted to you, your sons, the one left behind before in bonds, and the youngest one, whom you are now taking with you, still inexperienced in affairs." So they set out and pressed on toward Egypt. Then, a few days later, the steward of the country saw them arrive and was greatly pleased, and ordered the man in charge of his household to prepare a lavish meal and to bring the men in to share salt and table with him. When they were brought in, not understanding why, they were thrown into alarm, and in their confusion supposed they were about to be falsely charged with theft, as though they had made off with the price of the grain, which they had earlier found in their sacks. So they approached the steward of the household and began defending themselves against a charge no one had dared to bring, trying to heal their own guilty conscience, and at the same time bringing out and displaying the silver to give it back. But he, with kind and humane words, put them more at ease, saying, "No one is so impious as to malign the graces of God, may he be gracious to you. For he has rained treasures down into your sacks, giving you freely not only food but wealth as well." Comforted by this, they set out in order the gifts they had brought from home, and offered them when the master of the household arrived. When he asked how they were faring, and whether their father was still alive, the one they had spoken of before, they answered nothing about themselves, but concerning their father, that he was alive and well. Having invoked a blessing on him and called him most dear to God, he looked around for his brother born of the same mother. And when he saw him, unable to restrain himself and now overcome by feeling, before he could be discovered, he turned away and, running off on the pretext of some urgent matter, for it was not the moment to blurt out the truth, he wept in some inner chamber of the house. He let the flood of tears pour out. Then, having washed his face, he mastered his grief by reasoning, and came forward and gave a feast for the strangers, first restoring the one who had been held as a hostage in place of the youngest. Others among the eminent Egyptians also joined the banquet. The seating was arranged for each according to their own ancestral customs, since he considered it a serious matter to disregard time-honored laws, especially at a banquet, where the pleasures ought to outweigh the discomforts. Next, when he ordered them to be seated in order of age, people at that time not yet using reclining couches at their banquets, the brothers marveled that Egyptians should be zealous for the same customs as the Hebrews, mindful of proper order and skilled at distinguishing the honors due to elder and younger. Perhaps, they said, In earlier times, the country had been rather uninstructed in matters of diet. But this man, once set over public affairs, had brought good order not only to the great matters through which the successes of peace and war are naturally achieved, but also to what seem the more trivial things, most of which belong to amusements. For banquets seek out cheerfulness and have little patience for a companion who is too solemn and severe. While they quietly strung together praises of this kind, tables not especially lavish were brought in, since their host, because of the famine, did not think it right to indulge in luxury amid the misfortunes of others. And they, being men of exact judgment, took this too into their praises, saying that he had turned away from vulgar ostentation, a thing that provokes envy, and that in this way he preserved both the bearing of one who shares the suffering of the needy and the bearing of a generous host, placing himself on the border between the two and escaping the blame that attaches to each. So the preparations, being suited to the occasion, gave no grounds for reproach, and what they lacked in abundance was made up for by continual marks of goodwill toasts, wishes, and words of encouragement, meant to restore the spirit things more pleasant to free people of cultivated character than all the elaborate arrangements of food and drink, which lovers of feasting and lovers of dinners, men of shallow mind, parade for display, though such things are worth no serious attention. The next day, at dawn, he sent for the steward of his household and ordered him to fill the men's sacks with grain, and again to place the payment in purses at the mouths of the sacks, and in the sack of the youngest to place also the finest of the silver cups, the one he himself was accustomed to drink from. He carried out his instructions eagerly, taking no one as witness. And the brothers, knowing nothing of what had been done in secret, set out on their journey, rejoicing in all the good things that had come to them beyond their hopes. For this is what they had expected, that they would face a false charge over the money that had been returned to them as though they had stolen it, that they would not get back the brother held as hostage, and that they might, in addition, lose the youngest as well, forcibly detained by the very man who had been so eager to have him brought. But what actually happened surpassed even their most favorable hopes. Beyond escaping false accusation, they had shared in table and salt, which have been discovered by human beings as tokens of genuine friendship. They had recovered their brother unharmed, without anyone having interceded or pleaded on his behalf. They had brought the youngest back to their father safe, having escaped the suspicion of being spies, and were bringing home an abundant supply of food, and could reckon good things for the future as well. For, they said, if their provisions should run short again, they would no longer travel in fear as before, but with joy, as to a governor of the country who was now their own, rather than a stranger that they would journey to. But while they were in this frame of mind, and turning over such thoughts in their souls, a sudden and unexpected disturbance overtook them. For the steward of the household, acting under orders and bringing with him no small number of servants, came running after them, waving his hands and signaling them to stop. Straining forward, out of breath, he said, "You have sealed your former guilt upon yourselves once again. Repaying good with evil, you have turned back to the same path of wrongdoing. Having secretly taken back the price of the grain, you have gone on to do something still worse for wickedness. Once it meets with impunity, only grows bolder. You have stolen the finest and most precious cup of my master, the one from which he drank your health, you, so very grateful, so very peaceable, you who do not even know the word spy. You who brought back double the money to repay what was owed before a trap, it seems, and a bait set for the hunting and seizing of still more. But wickedness does not prosper forever. Forever scheming to escape notice, it is at last caught out." As he strung these words together, they were struck speechless, grief and fear, the most grievous of afflictions having fallen upon them all at once, so that they could not even open their mouths. For the onset of unexpected misfortunes brings speechlessness even upon those most skilled in speech. Yet, though overcome, they would not remain silent, for fear of seeming to be caught by their own guilty conscience, and said, "How shall we defend ourselves, and before whom? For you, the accuser, are about to be the judge as well, though you ought rather, from your own experience of us, to speak in our defense even against the accusations of others. Did we not bring back, unbidden and though no one had detected it, the money found earlier in our sacks, meaning to repay it? And have we now undergone such a change of character as to repay our host with damages and theft? No, this has not happened, nor would it ever enter our minds. Whichever of our brothers is found in possession of the cup, let him die. For we ourselves would judge this wrongdoing, if it has truly happened, worthy of death for many reasons. First, because greed and the desire for what belongs to another are utterly lawless. Second, because to attempt to harm one's benefactor is the height of impiety. Third, because for those who pride themselves greatly on noble birth to dare, by shameful deeds, to tear down the dignity of their ancestors is the most disgraceful reproach of all. If any of us is guilty of all these things, having done deeds worthy of 1,000 deaths, let him die. And as they spoke, they took down the loads from their pack animals and urged the steward to search with every care. He, knowing well that it lay in the sack of the youngest, since he himself had secretly placed it there, played his part cunningly. Beginning with the eldest, he examined each sack in turn following the order of their ages, as each man brought his sack forward and displayed it, until he came to the last, in whose sack the sought-for object was indeed found so that, seeing it all together, they cried out and tore their garments and wept and groaned aloud, mourning in advance for their brother while he was still alive, and no less for themselves and for their father, who had foretold the misfortunes that would befall this son, on account of which he had refused, though they wished it, to let his brother travel with them. Downcast and in utter confusion, they turned back along the same road to the city, thunderstruck at what had happened, believing the whole affair to be some plot rather than their brother's greed for money. Then, brought before the governor of the country, they displayed a brotherly devotion springing from genuine feeling. For falling all together at his knees, as though every one of them were guilty of the theft, a thing it is not even right to say of them, they wept in streams, they begged, they gave themselves up, they promised voluntary slavery, they addressed him as master, and, leaving out no name applied to household slaves, they called themselves outcasts, homebred servants, men bought with silver. But he, testing them still further, said to them with the gravest manner, "Far be it from me to do such a thing as to carry off so many for the fault of one. For what reason would justify calling to share in the punishment those who did not share in the wrongdoing? Let that one alone be punished, since he alone committed the act. I understand, in fact, that before you reached the city you yourselves decreed death for whoever should be found guilty. But I, weighing everything by fairness and a gentler measure, lighten the penalty, appointing slavery instead of death." While they bore the threat with distress and shrank down under the false charge they faced, the fourth in order of age, a man bold yet reverent, courageous, and practiced in a frankness of speech free from shamelessness, came forward and said, "I beg you, master, do not indulge your anger, nor, because you hold the rank second only to the king, condemn us in advance before we have made our defense. When you asked us, on your former visit, about our brother and our father, we answered you. Our father is an old man, aged not so much by the passage of time as by one misfortune after another, under whose discipline, like an athlete, he has continued in labors and hardships scarcely endurable. Our brother is quite young, extraordinarily beloved by our father, since he was born late in his life, and of the two sons born of the same mother, he alone remains, the elder having died a violent death. When you ordered us to bring our brother here, and threatened that unless he came we would not be permitted to come into your presence again, we departed downcast, and, scarcely able to bear it, returned home and reported to our father what you had said. At first he refused, being greatly afraid for the boy. But when our provisions ran short and none of us dared come to buy grain without the youngest, because of your threats, he was at last persuaded to send him with us, blaming us 1,000 times over for having admitted that we had another brother, and lamenting 1,000 times over the prospect of being parted from him. For he is still a child, inexperienced in affairs, not only those of a foreign land, but even those of his own city. How then could we return to our father in this state of mind? With what eyes could we bear to look at him without this boy? He will meet the most pitiable end the moment he hears that the boy has not come back. And then everyone who bears us ill will and delights in such misfortunes will call us murderers of a man, killers of our own father. The greater part of the accusation will fall on me. For I made many promises to my father, undertaking to bring back a deposit I was receiving, one I would restore whenever it was demanded of me. But how could I restore it, unless you yourself become gracious? I beg you to take pity on the old man, and to consider the miseries with which he will be afflicted if he fails to recover the one he entrusted to me against his better judgment. But as for you, exact whatever penalty you think fitting for the wrongs you believe you have suffered. I will give myself up willingly. Enroll me as a slave from this very day. I will gladly endure the lot of the newly bought, if only you will consent to let the boy go. And it is not I myself who will receive the favor, if indeed you grant it, but the one who is absent, relieved of his cares, the father of all of us who are suppliants here. For we are suppliants who have taken refuge at your most gracious right hand, of which may we never fail. Let pity, then, enter into you for an old man who has toiled through the contests of virtue at every stage of his life. He turned the cities of Syria to receive and honor him, even though he practiced customs and laws quite foreign to them and far removed from their own, not estranged in any small measure from the ways of the country. But the nobility of his life, and the harmony and agreement between his deeds and his words, and between his words and his deeds, prevailed, so that even those unfavorably disposed toward him on account of his ancestral customs were won over. Such is the favor you are about to bestow, one than which no one could receive a greater. For what gift could be greater to a father than to recover a son given up for lost? All this, and what had gone before, were tests, by which the governor of the land was observing their disposition toward their brother by the same mother. For he feared they might harbor some natural estrangement toward him, as sometimes happens with sons of a stepmother toward the household of another wife held in equal honor. For this reason, he had accused them as spies and inquired about their family, using this as a pretext to learn whether his brother was still alive and had not been destroyed through some plot. And he detained one of them, letting the others depart on their undertaking to bring back the youngest, whom he longed above all to see, and by whose presence he wished to be freed from the harsh and heaviest grief he felt on his account. And when he had arrived and he beheld his brother, relieved a little of his anxiety, he invited him to be his guest, and, feasting him, entertained his brother by the same mother with more lavish preparations, watching each of the others closely and judging from their faces whether any envy lurked hidden within them. And when he saw them rejoicing and warming with pleasure at the honor shown the youngest, having already noted from two proofs that no hidden hostility smoldered, he devised a third. He laid on the youngest the charge of having stolen the cup that seemed to be missing. For this was bound to become the clearest test of each one's mind and of his attachment to the brother, now falsely accused. From all this, he was now persuaded that no faction or plot was being raised against the household of his mother, and he drew the reasonable conclusion also about what had happened to himself, that he had suffered these things not so much through the plotting of his brothers as through the providence of God, who looks far ahead and sees the future no less than the present. Then he moved toward reconciliation and agreement, overcome by affection for his own family. And so that he might cast no reproach upon his brothers for what they had done, he thought it right that none of the Egyptians should be present at the first disclosure. Instead, having ordered the whole retinue to withdraw, he suddenly let loose a fountain of tears, and signaling with his right hand for them to come nearer, so that not even by chance could anyone else overhear, he said to them, "A matter that has lain in shadow and seemed hidden for a long time, I am now about to uncover. Alone, to you alone, I unveil it. The brother whom you sold into Egypt, that man whom you now see standing before you, I am he." And when they were struck with astonishment beyond all hope and thrown into confusion, and had, as if by some violent force, cast their eyes down to the ground and stood fixed, speechless and open-mouthed, he said, "Do not be downcast. I grant an amnesty for everything done against me. You need no other advocate. Of my own accord, and by my own free judgment, I have come willingly to a reconciliation, taking as my two counselors reverence for our father, to whom I attribute the greatest part of this favor, and natural love of humanity, which I show toward all, but especially toward those of my own blood. And I consider that not you, but God has been the cause of what has happened, since he willed that I should become the servant and minister of his own graces and gifts, which in the times of greatest need, he saw fit to grant to the human race. You can take clear proof of this from what you see. I have been entrusted with the whole of Egypt, and I hold the first place of honor with the king, and though I am young, he, though older, honors me as a father. And I am attended not only by the people of this land, but by very many other nations besides, both those subject to Egypt and those independent of it. For everyone has need of one who presides, because of the scarcity. Silver and gold, and more necessary than these, food, are stored up in my keeping alone, to be distributed and portioned out for the necessary needs of each who is in want, so that nothing is left over for luxury, and nothing is lacking for the fulfillment of need. But I have not gone through all this out of vanity or self-importance, but so that you might perceive that no man of such stature was destined to become responsible for one who had been a slave and afterward a prisoner. For indeed I was once bound, falsely accused, but rather that he who transformed the utmost misfortunes and misadventures into the highest and first successes was God, to whom all things are possible. Since this is my thinking, be no longer anxious. Put your distress out of the way and change over to cheerful good spirits. And it would be well to hasten to our father and be the first to bring him the good news of my having been found, for rumors outrun everything, everywhere. And they, taking up his praises one after another in unbroken succession, sang his praises with unbridled mouths, each dwelling on some different point. One on his freedom from resentment, another on his love of family, another on his understanding, and altogether on his piety in referring to God the outcome of his successes, and no longer resenting the unwelcome beginnings and first difficulties of what had not turned out according to his own will, and his surpassing, modest endurance. He who, amid so many changes of fortune, neither, while a slave, spoke any evil against his brothers as men who had sold him, nor, when led away to prison in despondency, blurted out any of the secret matters, nor, remaining there a long time, stripped bare, as prisoners are wont to do, the reckoning of his own misfortunes. But as though he knew nothing of what had happened to him, not even when he interpreted the dreams for the eunuchs or for the king, though he had a fitting occasion to disclose it, did he utter a word about his own noble birth. Nor when he was appointed viceroy of the king and took over the charge and oversight of the whole of Egypt, so that he should not seem to be one of the neglected and obscure, but in truth well-born, by nature not a slave, but one who had endured irreparable plots and misfortunes at the hands of those from whom he least deserved them. Beyond this, great praise was also poured out for his fairness and tact. For knowing the arrogance and lack of education of other rulers, they marveled at his lack of ostentation and freedom from theatrical display, and at how, though he might, on seeing them the first time, have had them put to death, or at the very least, since they were starving, have refused to supply them with food, besides not punishing them, he gave them provisions as a free gift, as though they deserved gratitude, and ordered that their money be returned to them. So thoroughly, indeed, was the matter of the plot, and the sale kept unknown and hidden, that the leading men of Egypt rejoiced together, as though the brothers of their governor had only now for the first time arrived, and invited them to be their guests, and hastened to bring the good news to the king, and everything everywhere was filled with joy no less than if. The plain yielded abundantly, and the famine turned to plenty. And when the king learned that Joseph had a father, and that his family was numerous, he urged him to move his whole household, promising that he had granted to those who came the richest region of Egypt. So he gave the brothers wagons and carriages, and a great number of pack animals loaded with provisions, and an ample retinue of attendants, so that they might bring their father back in safety. When they arrived and told their unbelievable story about their brother, more wonderful than they had ever hoped, Jacob would not quite believe it, for however trustworthy the tellers, the sheer enormity of the thing would not easily allow him to assent. But the old man, seeing the abundant provisions and supplies furnished for such an occasion, all in keeping with the good fortune reported to him, praised God, because the part of his household that seemed to have been lost he had restored in full. But his joy at once gave birth to fear in his soul, over the prospect of leaving his ancestral ways behind. For he knew that youth is by nature prone to slip, and that a foreign land grants a kind of license to sin, especially since Egypt is blind concerning the true God, on account of its habit of fashioning gods out of things generated and mortal, And because, besides, a tax of wealth and reputation are laid upon feeble minds. And he feared that his son, left behind with none of the disciplined guardians of his father's house to accompany him, alone and bereft of good teachers, would be ready to be changed by foreign ways. Seeing him disposed in this way, he to whom alone it is possible to see the invisible soul, God took pity on him, and appearing to him in a dream by night said, "Have no fear about your journey to Egypt. I myself will guide the way, making the journey safe and pleasant. And I will restore to you, too, the son you have longed for, who once was thought dead after so many years, and now is revealed not only alive but ruler of so great a land." Filled with good hope, rejoicing at the break of day, he hastened on. And when the son heard, for scouts and messengers had reported the whole journey to him, that his father was not far from the borders, he went quickly to meet him. And meeting at the place called Hierapolis, they fell upon each other, resting their heads on one another's shoulders and drenching their garments with tears. They took their fill, insatiably, of long embraces. And when at last they could stop, they pressed on together as far as the royal residence. And the king, seeing him, and struck with awe at the dignity of his appearance, received him with all reverence and honor, as though he were not another's father but his own. And after the customary and also extraordinary tokens of friendship, he gave him a portion of land that was fertile and very productive. And learning that Joseph's sons were herdsmen, possessed of great wealth in livestock, he set them in charge of his own flocks and herds, entrusting to them his goat herds and cattle herds and sheep flocks and countless other droves. And the young man made use of such an excess of faithfulness that, although the times and circumstances offered him the greatest possible occasions for enriching himself, and though he could, in a short while, have become the wealthiest man of his generation, he admired the truly genuine wealth above the counterfeit, and the seeing wealth above the blind. And so he deposited in the king's treasuries all the silver and gold that he had gathered from the sale of the grain, appropriating not a single drachma for himself, but content with the gifts alone which the king, in exchange, bestowed on him. And as though Egypt and, along with it, the other lands and peoples oppressed by famine were one single household, this man administered them beyond all telling, distributing the food fittingly, and looking not only to present advantage, but also to future benefit. When, at any rate, the seventh year of the scarcity had come, for by now there was hope of abundance and plenty, he summoned the farmers and gave them barley and wheat for seed, taking care that no one should misappropriate what he received but should deposit it in the fields, having chosen inspectors and overseers by merit, who would watch over the sowing. After the famine, a long time later, when their father had died, the brothers were struck with suspicion, and fearing they might suffer something harsh in reprisal for the old wrong, came to him and begged earnestly, bringing with them their wives and children. But he, with tears, said, "The occasion is enough to produce suspicion in those who have done unbearable things and are convicted by nothing so much as by their own conscience. For the death of our father has renewed the old fear you had before our reconciliation, as though I had granted the amnesty only for our father's sake, so as not to grieve him. But I do not change my character with the passing of time, nor, having professed to be at peace, will I ever do what breaks the peace. For I was not merely biding my time in reserve for vengeance, but I was granting you, for all time, release from punishment, assigning it partly, I must be honest, to honor for our father, and partly to the goodwill that was owed to you. And if I did all these kind and humane things for our father's sake, I will keep them even now that our father is dead. For in my judgment no good man has died, but he will live forever, ageless, in an immortal nature, his soul no longer bound by the constraints of the body. But why should we remember only our begotten Father? We have the unbegotten, the imperishable, the eternal, who oversees all things and hears all things, even those done in silence, who ever sees even what is hidden in the recesses of the mind. Him I call to witness my conscience, that our reconciliation is without deceit. For I, and do not marvel at my words, belong to God, Jen. 50:19. Who transformed your evil designs into an abundance of good things. So have no fear, and you will share in more useful things for the future than you enjoyed while our father was still living. Having encouraged his brothers with such words, he confirmed his promises still more by his deeds, omitting nothing that concerned their care. After the famine, when the inhabitants of the land were already rejoicing in its abundance and prosperity, he was honored by all, who repaid him in return for the good he had done them in the years of misfortune. And the report of it, spreading, filled the neighboring cities with his renown. He lived 110 years and died in a good old age, having reached the very summit of beauty, wisdom, and eloquence. To his bodily beauty, the passion that drove a woman mad for him bears witness. To his understanding, the evenness that, amid the countless irregularities of his life, produced harmony out of what was discordant and conquered out of what was in itself unconcordant. To the power of his words, both his interpretation of dreams and the eloquence of his conversation and the persuasiveness that attended it, on account of which none of those under his rule obeyed him more from necessity than from willingness. Of these years, he spent 17, up to adolescence, in his father's house, 13 amid unwanted misfortunes, plotted against, sold, enslaved, falsely accused, bound in prison, and the remaining 80 in rule and every kind of prosperity, as overseer of famine and plenty and best steward of both, most capable of managing affairs fittingly for either season.